man, a mortal invader among the shades of the dead. Now he was a shade himself. And no shade, no matter the greatness of the hero it had been in life, ever escaped from the kingdom of Hades. He checked himself over as he fell endlessly. His skin appeared as white as it had been in life, his tattoos as red. His flesh felt as solid as it ever had, his arms as strong. No mark remained of the giant weapon that had ripped him out of mortal life. He felt, surprisingly enough, thoroughly fine. He thought of his wife and child already in the underworld ahead of him. His punishment might be to kill them over and over for all eternity, unable to stop himself, in the same way as fresh fruit and pure water were eternally just beyond the grasp of Tantalus. The wind whipped at his face, resolve hardened in his chest. He was a warrior of Sparta. Until he found himself in Charon's boat, rowing across the river Styx, he was not dead. Not quite. What state he might actually inhabit was a question best left for a philosopher, since Kratos had never been interested in abstractions. He didn't mind dying. He only wanted to make sure that the weeping shade of Ares reached the Styx first. He had fallen so far that now he began to see the landscape of the underworld. Though he was still too high to see the river, he began to pick out solid-seeming bone-white structures that stood or crossed or loomed in the blood-colored gloom below. Falling still more, he discovered that these structures were bone-white for a very good reason. They were bones. Bones too large to belong to even gods. Kratos fell past a rib cage, in which each rib was larger than the Hydra's master head. Below the ribs he spied a spinal column in which each vertebra was the size of the Parthenon. He tucked his arms tightly to his body and spread his legs just enough to tip him face downward. As he fell, slight adjustments in the span of his legs, or the angle of one or both of his hands, kept him angling toward the great bony protuberances. He didn't worry about how hard he was going to land. He was already dead. How much harm could it do? He plummeted toward the spine at an astonishing speed. As he fell closer and closer, he could make out the tiny figures of other shades who'd had the same inspiration. They sat, or lay, or clung desperately to the bones, seeming to want only to delay their final plunge to the Styx. His last few yards passed at blinding speed, and the impact came in a shattering white flash, with no pain at all, which was what he had expected. What he had not expected was that he would bounce. He found himself tumbling again, flailing. He struck another vertebra, but skidded over the edge before he could get a grip. Scrambling desperately now, he clutched at anything he passed, because he was about to go over the edge of the tailbone and didn't see anything else between him and the sluggish black river that marked the border of Hades. At the last instant, his hand caught something. He heard a scream of panic, and as he dangled by one hand above that all-too-final drop, he discovered that he had grabbed a bony, withered ankle.
"Let go, idiot!" the man he'd grabbed screamed. "I can't hold us both!" "Just hang on," Kratos said through his teeth. "Hold tight, and I'll get us out of this."
Grimly, he pulled himself up to where he could get a grip on the man's knee with his other hand.
"My arms!" moaned the man. "You're pulling my arms out of their sockets! Let go!"
Kratos counted himself lucky. The man was so withered that the Spartan could close his hand around the fellow's thigh. The man tried to kick him off.
"You won't drag me down to that cursed river!" "There's a task left for me above," Kratos growled, "and I will see it completed." "I don't care! Let go!"
The man screamed as Kratos hauled himself higher and drove his hand like a spear deeply into the man's side. He hooked his fingers over the man's hip bone and kept on climbing. His next handhold was at the man's shoulder, then his other shoulder, and finally Kratos could grasp the same prominence that the other clung to. It was then a simple matter for Kratos to clamber up onto the vertebra. He turned back to the man he had used as a ladder. It was the captain of the merchant ship from the Grave of Ships. The captain recognized Kratos in the same instant. A look of pure horror twisted his face.
"Oh, no! Not you again!"
Kratos stepped close to the edge and kicked the captain's hands off the bone. The captain had a penetrating voice, and Kratos heard him screaming curses as his shade cartwheeled downward to vanish in the blood mist above the Styx. Kratos turned and scanned the skeletal landscape. He began to climb. Scaling vertebra after vertebra, he toiled upward for an unknown span of time. The light here never changed, and Kratos never tired. He kept climbing. When he reached the ribs, miles above where he had begun, he discovered a new feature of this peculiar realm. Undead. Skeletons. Legionnaires. But these were no naked shades. They were armored, armed with all manner of weapons, and thirsty for blood, as they had been in the world above. They spread out to intercept his passage. As they moved into position, Kratos saw that they were not alone. Two minotaurs bearing battle axes and a massive centaur brandishing a sword as long as Kratos was tall stood with them. The centaur looked familiar.
"I know you, Spartan," the centaur growled. "You sent me here only days ago, on a street in Athens. And it's so with all of you, isn't it? I killed you all."
The centaur grinned hugely, opening his arms as if in welcome.
"All of us are here to return the favor."
Kratos looked farther up and discovered he could chart his path by noting where creatures waited for him. Every bone that led upward was crowded with enemies who had died at his hands. He began to climb the bone up to the first group. The centaur bellowed, whirling his enormous sword around his head. Hours, days, months, decades, Kratos spent in battle. Still he never tired, and the light never changed, and he never ran out of enemies. He climbed, and then he fought. He jumped, then found himself facing a column of immense height, studded with counter-rotating segments of viciously sharp blades. Kratos stepped back and tried to see the top of the column. It vanished into the blood-red mists above. The swish-swish of the rotating blades cut through the air, but could not drown out the cries of men and women falling to Lord Hades's embrace far below. Kratos had come a considerable distance to reach this point, and there was more to go if he wanted to kill a god. Taking a deep breath, Kratos watched the blades whirling about and judged the safe rings. But he knew they could never be considered islands of refuge. The rings did not spin at uniform rates. Some above went faster, while those on either side rotated more slowly. Once he started the climb, there would be no turning back, no rest, not an instant of hesitation. Two quick steps and a jump took him above the first ring of curved blades. Kratos almost found his escape from Lord Hades's grip at an end as the blade under his left foot cut off part of his sandal. He jerked upward and almost foolishly looked down. No rest, no stopping. The blades above came fast at eye level, scrambling, finding purchase against the ever-moving rings. A toehold and a hard push upward barely allowed him to escape decapitation. He slowed, then shot upward, fingers finding the right gripping points to avoid the next ring of blades, and the next, and the next. Then he saw that the ring above rotated against the others and forced him to retreat. Kratos dropped down, but surged up when a break came in the deadly ring. He found a rhythm to the climb, a certain logic to the seemingly random whirl of death around him. But a screech from behind warned him of a harpy coming at his back. Not daring to take his attention from the segmented tower of blades, he kept climbing. Blood spat at his back and ran in thick rivers to drip down to the spot where he had begun the climb. The harpy had incautiously attacked him and ignored a set of blades coming from the opposite direction. It paid the price. A quick glance showed the headless body tumbling away in one direction. He never saw the head. He was too occupied with preventing such a fate from befalling him. Twice the flashing blades almost lopped off vital pieces of anatomy. One wound was minor, but a steady gush of blood came from a deep cut to his ribs, just as he saw the top of the deadly column. Sanctuary in sight spurred him on, and the wind whistling from the blades chilled his body as sweat evaporated from his exertions. Close to the pinnacle, with only one ring of blades to pass, Kratos surged upward, let a sharp edge graze his leg, and then tumbled flat onto the top of the column. He immediately found himself faced with a tall legionnaire armored in flames. Kratos somersaulted, came to his feet, and brought the blades of chaos into his hands. The climb had set his pulse racing, and every sense was heightened. The legionnaire had no chance against his quick cuts and sudden leap high into the air. He hurtled downward, the blades preceding him. The legionnaire exploded in a ball of fire as the tip of one blade drove down hard onto the back of the undead skull. Kratos stood, staring at the pile of ash that marked the legionnaire's final resting place. He kicked the ash over the edge, sending it floating eventually to drift on the river Styx. Looking around, he saw nowhere to go from the apex of the column. Kratos looked back down through the blur of spinning blades. If he had to retreat and find another way, he would. As he stepped to the edge to begin his descent, a new sound filled the air, drowning out the cries of those unfortunates falling to the underworld. He jumped back in time to avoid being crushed by a heavy block. A grim smile curled Kratos' lips. Tied to the block was a rope that vanished upward. He might have to deal with harpies, but the spinning blades of the column beneath his feet were a danger past. Gathering his strength, he bent his legs and exploded upward, grasping the rope as far above as possible. Hand over hand, he continued his escape as he went through dozens or thousands of weapons looted from the corpses of his enemies. Though a shade, he could be hurt by these enemies, he discovered. But victory healed his wounds. The underworld behind him vanished as he clambered higher, finally seeing a ceiling above. Kratos wondered at what appeared to be roots dangling from the bottom. As he got closer, he saw that they were roots, roots of living plants from the world above. The living world above. Kratos climbed faster and followed the rope into a hole that blocked all senses. His shoulders brushed dirt, and then the hole narrowed even more, but the rope still stretched taut above him. Ascending more slowly, he felt himself being crushed and smothered, and he knew the smell in his nostrils, and the taste in his mouth. Dirt. Clay. Earth. He spat out a mouthful of grit and sealed his lips. With an effort greater than he'd ever before believed he could summon, Kratos forced his hands and then his arms to move. He pressed his limbs outward, using his great strength to pack the smothering earth away from him, opening a little room to work. He began to move his legs as well, struggling to bend his knees or widen his stance. His heart hammered, and his lungs burned for air. He told himself repeatedly, "Shades don't need to breathe." Without pausing to marvel at this miracle, or to ponder the question of its source, Kratos clawed his way upward, snarling and gasping and forcing his weakening limbs to move, to climb, to rip apart the dirt above him and break through to light and air. Just when his pounding heart seemed to be choking him to death, his hand broke through. Fresh air gusted into his face. His fatigue vanished. Furiously he attacked the imprisoning earth, until he could see a night shrouded by clouds glowing blood-red with the light of fires below. "Athens," he croaked. "I'm in Athens." He pulled himself up to the mouth of the hole he had dug and discovered there were still 6 more feet to go. He stood in an open grave. 29. In the open grave, Kratos's skin prickled as though he had felt a sudden chill. He turned and looked up, and yes, he was where he thought he was, the grave that had been dug beside the temple of Athena. Kratos vaulted from the grave and looked out over the burning city. In the distance he saw the immense shape of Ares striding through the city, stomping buildings at random. Ah, Kratos, right on time. I finished digging only a moment ago. The unexpected voice startled Kratos into a whirl. He crouched, ready to fight for his newly regained life. But there was no danger here. Behind him stood only the old gravedigger. Now, though, the gravedigger did not look so old, or nearly so decrepit, and his voice had none of his formerly senile quaver. Intelligence burned brightly in his once murky eyes.
"Who are you?"
"An interesting question, but one we don't have time to answer, my boy. You must hurry. Athens needs you."
But...
Kratos gestured in helpless bafflement at the empty grave.
"But how did you know?"
"How could you know I would... Athena isn't the only god keeping watch on you, Spartan. You have gone far to prove your worth, but your final task lies ahead of you." Kratos turned as a thunderous roar erupted from the direction of Athens. Ares towered above, meting out destruction and laughing in triumph. Kratos felt his rage building. Without turning to the gravedigger, he asked,
"Who are you?"
Kratos spoke to empty air. The gravedigger had disappeared like smoke in the wind. There came an answering whisper, a zephyr blowing in his ear.
"Complete your task, Kratos, and the gods will forgive your sins."
The Spartan shook his head grimly.
"How can I do this without Pandora's box?"
For all the weapons he still carried, Kratos knew that they would hardly even muss Ares's flame-laced hair. He gazed across the burning ruin of Athens to where the god of war stood shouting his triumph to the heavens. Kratos steeled himself as he remembered an old maxim. Spartans fight with the weapons they have, not the weapons they want. The hour of decision had finally come. Time to kill. Time to die. Kratos started walking. A strangled, gasping moan came to Kratos' ear as he headed for the chasm he had only barely crossed as the lone bridge was destroyed. It came from within the temple of Athena. It sounded like a woman moaning in agony, gasping for a last few breaths. Hearing this, Kratos found himself glad that at least his wife and daughter had not suffered. He had given them swift, almost painless deaths, cleaner than the woman inside. Probably the Oracle, he thought. And then he stopped. If it was the Oracle, he had one last question for her. He trotted up the front steps of the temple. The whole floor was splotched with dried blood. He went to the immense statue of Athena and stood before it, gazing up into the blank marble eyes.
"No box, only the weapons I had before," he said, spinning the blades of chaos around. "Any advice?"
The marble face of the statue remained stubbornly blank. Kratos turned away and went behind the altar to the corridor that led to the Oracle's quarters. A dozen long strides took him to the empty room. Nothing in there but a few dead leaves. Back in the temple, he looked around for the source of the soft moans. He turned slowly, listening hard. Above. Somewhere above. The temple roof had been blasted to pieces. A quick sprint, and he leaped onto the altar, springing again up the side of Athena's statue to the head, and then a prodigious leap propelled him to the edge of the sundered roof. He barely made it. His left hand latched onto a shard of a rafter, and he hung there, dangling. Again the visions captured his mind. His wife and daughter in his arms, cruelly slaughtered on the village temple's floor. The curse of the Oracle that remade him into the ghost of Sparta. The swirl of his family's ashes clinging to his skin, forever staining both his flesh and his soul. Kratos grunted and pulled himself up to the roof. Sprawled a few steps away lay Athena's Oracle, her contorted position warning that her back had been broken. Many times in battle, Kratos had seen warriors in similar positions. It took hours, sometimes days, for them to die. He knelt beside the Oracle. She had seemed diminutive before. Now she was frail and old beyond her years. Her eyes flickered open when she felt his fingers on her cheek, and she squinted against the glare of the flames devouring distant Athens.
"You have returned," she said in a whisper. "You won the box and lost it. My visions, I saw."
"Then you know what happened to me."
She closed her eyes. Her skin had gone waxy, transparent as parchment, revealing the tangle of veins just under the surface. Kratos pressed his fingers harder into her cheek. She stirred.
"Tell me what you foresee," he said. "Tell me how I kill the god of war."
The oracle's lips twitched. Kratos bent closer to hear.
"The box,"
the oracle twitched spastically. She shook her head.
"Why are you chosen by Athena? You are a terrible man, a monster."
"A monster to kill a monster."
There came no reply. He spoke to a dead woman. He stood and stared at her body, hardly more than a child's in size, no matter the powers she had possessed in life. Now her shade was consigned to Lord Hades's embrace. He looked down upon the city, and then into the chasm. How would he get down from here? He noticed that one building on fire near the base of the cliff was moving, as though it somehow walked through the city. Within the fire turned a face toward the sky, and Kratos realized what he had thought was a building was in fact the blaze of Ares's hair, seen from above. The god seemed to be contemplating the view. In the blink of an eye, Ares was wiped from existence. Again Kratos felt a chilly prickle spread over his skin. That had been too much like the phantasmal Ares in the arena of remembrance, if the real Ares was as invulnerable as the imitation. He didn't let himself think about it. Then the voice that haunted Kratos's every nightmare roared from right behind him.
"Zeus! Do you see what your son can do?"
Kratos whirled and let his heart start beating again. Ares had no idea the Spartan was there. He'd only willed himself to the mountaintop because it held the most sacred temple of Athena. Ares boasted at the sky.
"You cast your favor on Athena, but her city lies in ruins before me."
The echoes of that gargantuan voice brought down more masonry around the temple. The god raised his fist, threatening the sky.
"And now even Pandora's box is mine. Would you have me use it against Olympus itself?"
Kratos, from his vantage point atop the temple roof, saw that the god was telling the truth. Though the massive box was dwarfed by the fist from which it dangled, there was no mistaking the eerie golden glow of its jewels. Pandora's box twisted at the end of a long, slender chain, as though it were a locket, an amulet for the god to wear for luck. Ares went on with his ranting, but Kratos no longer heard him. All his attention was now focused on that slender chain linking the box to the god's fist. He looked from that chain to the white scar on his palm, then back to the chain.
"Do not strike at the god, you say?"
He showed his teeth to the night like a rabid wolf.
"Fair enough,"
he said softly.
"Ares."
Hearing his name, the god turned to look back over his shoulder. He sniffed the air, as if to catch a pleasing savour.
"Kratos! Returned from the underworld."
Ares did not sound surprised. He seemed pleased. He lifted his face to the skies again and threw wide his arms.
"Is this the best you can do, father? You send a broken mortal to defeat me, the god of war."
Kratos didn't feel broken. He raised his right hand, felt the power of Zeus's thunderbolt surging within him as he took one step forward and unleashed war upon a god. 30. Who is the gravedigger? Zeus appeared to be taken aback by Athena's sudden question.
"Why, he digs graves."
"That's not an answer."
"But it is. Just not the answer you're hoping for."
Athena hid the beginning of a smile. The Sky Father's words led her to an inescapable conclusion. Zeus himself had been the gravedigger, and he supported Kratos. She knew he could not openly favor the Spartan because of his own edict. The other gods would protest. With so much turmoil in Olympus, thanks to Ares and his disobedience, Zeus walked carefully. He was king of the gods, but he could never withstand open rebellion among all the other gods. She exulted. Zeus aided Kratos in ways she did not know, but aid him he did. That increased Kratos's chance for success. Zeus had bestowed the power of the thunderbolt on her Kratos, surreptitiously. Athena needed even more from Zeus. Father, we must help Kratos more openly. He cannot hope to conquer Ares without our aid.
No!
Instantly changeable, Zeus jerked to his feet and now towered over her so that her whole body was in his shadow.
You will not help Kratos, because Ares's blood will not stain your hands.
Everything fell into place. The intricacy took her breath away. Zeus had maneuvered her so she would guide Kratos to where he, the Lord of Olympus, could bring about Ares's death. What more is there, Father? You said that Kratos had to prove himself to be worthy. Of what? What more than killing Ares do you plan for him?
You thought to use your mortal to accomplish your end, but I foresaw failure. Now there is a chance for Kratos to kill a god and attain more.
A chance, Athena said, but not a certainty. Zeus did not answer. 31. Swift as the thunderbolt was, it seemed to Kratos to be creeping through the thickest sort of treacle. The interval between it leaving his hand and reaching its target stretched longer than Kratos's whole life. He didn't wait to watch it hit. If it missed, he was dead anyway, and so he put himself where success would do him the most good. The instant his hands were free, he dove for the edge of the temple roof, caught an ornamental carving, and kicked off it again for the statue of Athena, heading for ground level. He was still in the air when the thunderbolt struck its target. Ares, still shouting his defiance at Zeus, never saw it coming. His first hint was a stinging shock in his right hand, and then he felt no more the weight of Pandora's box. The thunderbolt had struck home and done its job, severing the chain that joined the box to the hand of the god. What? Ares stared blankly at his fist, as though it had somehow betrayed him. What have you done? From Ares's upraised fist to the ground below was fully 100 feet. Kratos judged where the box would land and made for it with all his speed. His guess was good. The box landed on a pile of rubble only steps in front of him, and he dashed to it before Ares understood what had happened. Reaching up, Kratos gripped the lid and shoved as hard as he could. Unlike his attempt at Pandora's temple, the lid slid away without effort, almost as though the box wanted him to open it. Among the ruins of the Temple of Athena, Kratos of Sparta had opened Pandora's box for the first time since it was hidden in the temple atop Kronos's back a millennium ago. Kratos scrambled up the rubble and stood on the rim of the box, staring into its warm, sunny glow. Whatever was within shone too brightly for Kratos's eyes. He experienced a terrible instant of vertigo, as though he were about to plunge headlong into a hole deeper than the universe. But when the vertigo passed, his entire body warmed in the light, and the box seemed to shrink, dwindling to the size of a matron's jewel box. Kratos cried out as power surged through his body, filled his soul, and more. His arms rose above his head, and tiny sparks danced between his spread fingers. Never had he imagined such power. Was this what it felt like to be a god? Then Kratos looked at the god of war and discovered it was not the box that had shrunk. He had grown. Where before he had not stood as tall as Ares's ankle bone, he now looked the god square in the eyes. And in those eyes, he saw a flicker of fear. Ares chased away his dismay with towering fury. His face twisted into a contemptuous sneer. "You are still just a mortal, every bit as weak as the day you begged me to save your life."
"I am not the man you took that day."
Kratos straightened, and when he spoke, his voice too shook the mountain.
10 years I have waited. Tonight you die."
Ares' sneer expanded into dark laughter. "Athena has made you weak." Kratos dropped into his fighting crouch.
"Strong enough to kill you."
"Never." The god spread wide his arms, as though welcoming the arrival of his favorite son. "Give my regards to your family." Instead of meeting Kratos hand to hand, the god tapped some dark and eldritch power that washed over Kratos and into him and seized his mind entirely. The temple, the mountain, Athens, and the god himself were all wiped from Kratos' eyes, replaced by a village in flames. He fell to his knees. He knew this terrible place. He suffered it nightly in his dreams, in the visions that racked his days and filled every instant of his life. Mocking laughter rang in his ears. "I taught you many ways to kill, Kratos. Flesh burns, bones break. But to shatter a man's spirit is to truly destroy him." Snarling wordless rage and denial, Kratos shoved himself to his feet. He staggered through the flames in front of the village temple where he had killed his wife and daughter. "Do you recognize this place, Spartan? Perhaps you can undo your crime. If you beg me for mercy, I might let you stay your murders." Kratos burst through the temple door. His wife, his daughter, alive and unhurt, stood before him like the answer to every prayer to every god of his life. He tried to speak, but no words could break through the grip of the emotion that held his throat closed. Every nightmare during this terrible decade of torment whirled around him, smeared into one another, and took physical form before his eyes. "Kratos?" his wife said uncertainly, shading her eyes against the flames at his back. "What is happening? Where are we? Daddy?" His daughter threw herself toward him, but her mother caught the little girl's arm and held her back. The only time in his life Kratos had felt a blow so powerful and soul-killing was when Ares' javelin column had pinned him to the door of the Temple of Pandora.
"By the gods! Can this be real?"
"Kratos?" his wife said. "Have you come to take us home?" The wall of the temple suddenly shimmered, rippling as if it was no longer wholly a material thing, and out through that shimmer stepped Kratos. His younger self, the Kratos of a decade past, came striding into the temple to slay everything that moved. He put himself between his family and his younger self. His younger self came at him with the efficient, straight-ahead style that had been his trademark. Every step was a strike. Every strike was a step. His younger self was faster and stronger than Kratos was now, but strength and speed were never the only elements of victory. The air sizzled with the song of the Blades of Chaos. As they flashed around him, opening small cuts across his body, Kratos discovered he didn't like being on this side of the blades. The next time young Kratos hurled a blade outward to whip through the air, old Kratos stepped inside the strike and caught the blade by the chain. Its heat seared his hands, but he didn't care. He was used to pain. To win back his family, he could endure anything. He grabbed the blade's haft and yanked with all his might. His strength threw young Kratos into the air, but his younger self was fully as agile as he'd ever been. Instead of tumbling helplessly, young Kratos turned his flight into a pounce, the other blade raised for the kill. Old Kratos guessed it must have come as a considerable shock to young Kratos when his weapon arm was severed at the elbow, so that his hand, blade, and chain all fell harmlessly to the floor. Old Kratos mercifully spared him any additional shocks by slicing his skull into two pieces.
"Are you watching, Ares? You took them once. I will never lose them again."
As if in reply, spots on the temple wall shimmered again. Three of them. From each one a young, strong, fresh Kratos stalked forward. Kratos cursed Ares as he swung his blades of chaos at the trio of himself.
One at a time would have been too easy.
As the three advanced on his family, Kratos felt his uncontrollable bloodlust return, fed by the familiar blades of chaos in his grip. Kratos waded into them without hesitation, engaging two at once. The third took advantage of this opportunity to flank Kratos and kill his family, but he discovered to his dismay that his attack had been anticipated and countered. Blood showered from his severed neck, while his head bounced across the floor. These duplicates were younger and stronger, but they fought with the same blood-crazed ferocity that had driven Kratos to the worst of his crimes. Old Kratos, whatever else he might be, fought to control this blood rage, and was no longer a mindless killing machine. As his wife had wanted, he discarded the need only for spilled blood and substituted a fight for honor and family. Within 10 seconds, both of the remaining duplicates lay dead before him. Kratos stood over them, panting harshly, bleeding from dozens of cuts. Waiting.
"Kratos, please! I don't know where we are!" cried his wife. "Take us home!"
"Soon, I hope," Kratos said softly. "There is still work for me here."
This time there were five. They met the same fate as the others.
"You'll never get them, Ares. Send 10 of me. Send 1,000. I'll kill them all. Not one of them will touch my family."
The flames of the burning temple spoke to him in the voice of Ares.
"You gave them up in your quest for ultimate power. There is a price to pay for everything you gain." "Not that price. Never."
"No price is too high for what I offered you, fool. You dared to reject a god."
The fire's voice softened to silken malice.
"Here is the cost of that foolish act."
"I don't care." Kratos hefted the blades of chaos. "I'm ready."
"Are you?"
The blades of chaos came to life in his hands, moving with a will not his own. It was as though they had become hands that seized his wrists in unbreakable grips, and they began to drag him toward his family.
"No!" he howled. "Not again!"
He tried to drop the blades of chaos, to hurl them away, but they were welded to his hands. The chains in his forearms burned with a fury that blurred his vision with soul-tearing pain. For now the blades controlled him, not the other way around.
"Not again!"
The blades went up. The blades came down. And again. Now, 10 years on, Kratos stood over the bodies of his wife and child, murdered by the god of war.
"You should have joined me."
Kratos screamed then and fell to his knees. The scream was not one of terror or regret. It was not sorrow that unstrung his legs. It was rage. The fires in his heart burned hotter than the blades of chaos ever could.
"You should have been stronger."
Kratos could only howl with incoherent fury. "Now you will have no power, no magic, no weapon." Invisible hands seized the blades and yanked them from his grip. They surged away from each other, cranking his arms wide, stretching them out as though he was being broken on a wheel, harder and harder, until his shoulders screamed in pain, as though his arms would rip from their sockets. At the last, his flesh gave way before his joints did. The chains ripped free, shredding his arms, leaving the blackened tatters trailing smoke.
"All that is left for you is death."
With that final word from the god of war, the burning temple disappeared around Kratos. Kratos knelt on the night-shrouded rubble of the shattered temple of Athena, atop her sacred mountain, above her ruined city. A single tear trailed down his cheek and fell to the scree of broken masonry. He brought up a hand, gazing upon the charred ruin of his forearm, and then turned it toward the temple itself, as though inspecting how it dwarfed the great statue of Athena. When he looked up, his eyes were dry. Ares faced him across the ruin. He leaned upon his red-hot great sword as one might on a walking stick.
"No magic?"
The growl of god-sized Kratos boomed across the city, raising echoes from distant mountains.
"I have enough."
"You are still only a mortal, worthless and weak," sneered Ares.
"There's a dead woman on the floor of this temple. She said I'm a monster, and she was never wrong."
Kratos stood. He shook the kinks out of his limbs, sending drops of his lifeblood flying in all directions.
"I am your monster, Ares, and I've come to kill you."
Ares unleashed a roar of laughter. Then the fury of Ares erupted in a blast of flame and a thunderous shout, like a million soldiers screaming their war cries in unison. He raised the great sword over his head.
"Fight," he roared, "if you dare."
Ares came loping across the mountain summit, each step shaking the rock and breaking the temple to pieces. Kratos watched him like a stalking lion. And the real battle finally began. Athena watched the fight shown by the scrying pool before the throne of Olympus, Zeus at her side, her heart pounding until she could barely breathe. This was more than anxiety at having reached the climax of a decade-long plan. Astonishingly, she worried for Kratos. Though she could hardly believe it, she somehow had come to care for this surly, murderous mortal. When Kratos met Ares's charge by casting a handful of masonry chunks like sand into Ares's eyes, she caught her breath. When Kratos slipped aside from Ares's blind sword blows and tackled the god of war to the ground, she gasped. Kratos next pried up from the bedrock of the mountain a boulder that must have weighed tons. Now he was straining to bash Ares's Olympian brains into blood pudding. And Athena found herself on her feet with no memory of having stood.
"Now this is a fight!" Zeus exclaimed.
His eyes danced, and color was high on his cheeks. Tiny lightning flashes showed in his beard of clouds.
"None of this modern leaping around, swords and shields all the time. This is the way it used to be."
The king of Olympus shifted to a more comfortable position on the rim of the scrying pool.
"Kratos reflects well on your judgment and on all mortal kind. Can you imagine what must be going through Ares's head right now?"
Athena found her fists clenching and her shoulders twitching as though she could somehow will Kratos to win. When Ares kicked him off and made it back to his feet, she again could not breathe. The Spartan, though, without hesitation, threw himself back into the fight.
"This Spartan boy means a lot to you, does he?"
She jerked at the question, and then flushed with shame for being so transparent. "Of course," she said, forcing a veil of calm to cover her anxiety. "As you care for your eagles, father, I hope for his health and for his happiness."
"If he takes care of our Ares problem, at least he won't have to worry any more about his curse of kinslaughter. If he defeats Ares, his crimes will be forgiven. I have decreed it so."
"It is all he still hopes for," Athena said. "With forgiveness, his madness, the visions, the nightmares, will finally end." Zeus looked at her sidelong.
"Who said anything about his nightmares?"
She stared at her father. A dull shock of dread coursed through her heart and spread outward to her limbs.
"Father, the end to his nightmares. That's all he's been working for all these years."
"And to avenge his family's death," Zeus pointed out, "which he looks fair like to achieve from how things are going."
"Revenge is only a part of it," she insisted. "What good is forgiveness? He doesn't need his sins washed clean.
He needs a decent night's sleep.
Perhaps, Zeus said, but what he needs and what he deserves are not the same thing.
Father, you can't dangle this hope in front of him to gain 10 years of service and then just snatch it away.
I dangled, as you say, nothing at all. Whatever bargains have been struck between the two of you are none of my affair. There is more to this fight than you realize.
Athena could only sit and gape. Zeus drew himself up, and all his cheerful mockery and petty gamesmanship fell away. The radiant majesty of kingship shone from his face like the sun itself.
There is no crime worse than to spill the blood of one's own family. I bear the curse of that crime myself. It is a crime that may be justified, perhaps, since I acted to defend myself and to save all of you, and yet I am forever tainted with the curse of my crime. Kratos acted out of simple blood frenzy. That can never be changed.
He's not responsible for this.
His guilt will be cleansed, but still he is responsible. What has been done can never be undone. A deed so vile may be expiated some day, even forgiven. It can never be forgotten. He must find peace in his own way.
But, Father...
Calm yourself, child. Do not fear for your Spartan. I will take care of Kratos for you. He nodded down at the scrying pool. Look there. Ares may instead kill Kratos. Then we don't have a problem, do we?
You think Ares will win?
He does seem to have the upper hand at the moment.
Kratos and Ares were locked together, chest to chest, snarling and tearing at each other like maddened bears. Kratos had kept the whole fight inside grappling range so that Ares never got enough distance to use his weapon effectively. He kept one hand clenched on the god's sword wrist, and the other he forced up under the god's chin, driving back his head. The flames of the god's beard blistered Kratos's hand, but he had grown accustomed to such pain through all the years of wielding the blades of chaos. Ares snarled obscenities through his locked teeth as he punched with his free hand again and again into Kratos's kidney. A spreading numbness there buckled the Spartan's knee. Feeling his joint give way, Kratos, as any Spartan would, used what he was given. If he couldn't stand on that leg, he could still slam it into Ares's groin. For every punch the god delivered, Ares took a knee shot to the testicles in return, until even through the firelight of his hair and beard, his face began to show the pain. Kratos gave over the chin pressure in favor of slamming his elbow into the side of Ares's head, staggering the already weakened god. As Ares fell off balance, Kratos dived to his left, using his grip on the god's wrist to make Ares's sword hand take the full impact of both their weights as they fell sideways to the ground. Ares's fist shattered the bedrock where it struck, and the rock did the same to Ares's knuckles. Kratos got his knee between them then and kicked the god away from him, while twisting the sword from Ares's grasp. Ares scrambled drunkenly to his feet, cradling his broken hand. Kratos rolled up smoothly and slashed the air with a blurring flourish of Ares's sword. Lips peeled back from the Spartan's teeth.
How do you like your monster now?
Ares straightened and let his injured hand fall to his side. His feral predator's grin was a near-exact mirror of Kratos's face.
You have no idea what a true monster is, little Spartan. You get one lesson.
Ares hunched over, and his face blackened with strain. Bursting through the impenetrable armor on his back came jointed appendages, writhing like the legs of some nightmarish scorpion, armored in black shell and ending in blades longer than the columns of the Parthenon.
You won't live to need another.
With a clatter of his bladed limbs, Ares sprang like a wolf spider, every blade angled to drink deep the Spartan's blood. Kratos backpedaled. This was a foe he'd never imagined. Ares pressed the assault, stabbing his scorpion blades in concert, in a complex sequence impossible for Kratos to counter. The Spartan kept giving ground, parrying furiously, cutting at the limbs when he could, but their black shells were no less impenetrable than the god's mystic armor. But that mystic armor, Kratos noted, did not cover the war god's whole body. The next time Ares came for him, Kratos lunged and ran 10 yards of red-hot great sword through the god's inner thigh. On a mortal, that would have been a death blow. Cutting the large artery in the thigh would cause a man to bleed out in seconds. Gooey black ichor came oozing from the wound, but the only real effect it seemed to have was that Ares now used his blade limbs to lift his body from the ground. Just as they had served him for a sword arm, they now served him for legs. He lunged at Kratos again and again. Kratos gave ground, trying to circle, seeking any opening in the limb's baffling weave of death through which he might strike at the god's more vulnerable flesh. He was tiring rapidly now. Without the blades of chaos to feed life energy into him, his wounds stayed open and poured his strength out on the courtyard's flagstones. For one brief moment he actually thought that he would lose. But in that instant the faces of his wife and daughter rose up within his mind and ignited a fury unlike any he had ever known. All his strength roared into him, and more. The next time Ares came for him, Kratos smashed aside one limb's stab with such force that its blade struck a neighboring limb and cracked its armor. Kratos blinked at the obsidian ichor that leaked from the crack. A weakness? Ares drew back, his confidence shaken for a moment, but then he gathered himself for another assault. "Let's make it final," Kratos thought. He let his knees buckle, so that he swayed dizzily, and let the sword droop out of line. When the tip scraped on courtyard stone, his fingers opened nervelessly, and the sword clanked to the ground. Seeing such weakness, Ares sprang into the air, leaping high so as to fall upon Kratos and impale him on 2 blades at once. But as the war god leaped, Kratos's weakness vanished, and he sprang up to meet Ares in the air. His hands closed around the joint of 1 blade limb, and he twisted and bent it with irresistible strength, jamming its needle point through Ares's cuirass into the god's chest. Ares spasmed, and they fell, and Kratos wrenched his weight to fall on top of the god, letting his weight drive the blade limb fully through Ares's chest and out the back. With a roar that was more outrage than pain, Ares flung Kratos from him and spidered to his feet, staring down at the immense blade jammed through his chest with a kind of bafflement Kratos recalled all too well. It was exactly how he'd stared at the column with which Ares had speared him at the Temple of Pandora. Ares fell to his knees. Kratos rose and recovered the war god's sword. Ares stared up at him, in his eyes only fear and pleading.
"Kratos! Kratos, remember, it was I who saved you at your hour of greatest need."
Kratos raised the sword.
"That night, Kratos, please! That night I was trying only to make you a great warrior."
Kratos thrust Ares' own sword through the god's chest. As he limped away from the god's corpse, it began to twinkle with myriad lights. The lights turned into dancing motes that pulled away from the body and then swirled upward to the heavens, until with a blinding flash and a clap of thunder like the end of the world, nothing of Ares remained. Kratos was battered and bleeding, and once again only a man. He stared up in awe at the vast blade that only moments before he had wielded so lightly. Now he wasn't half as tall as the blade's narrowest point was wide. He limped back over the broken walls of the ruined temple to stand before the statue of the goddess.
"Athena," he said, "your city is saved. Ares is dead."
He gazed up into the blank marble eyes.
"I've done my part. Now you do yours. Wipe away these nightmares forever."
A shimmering glow of imminent godhead played over the marble. The eyes came alight, and the lips moved as Athena spoke. "You have done well, Kratos," the statue said. "Though we mourn the death of our brother, the gods are indebted to you." Kratos stood a little straighter. A dark chill trickled into his veins. We promised your sins would be forgiven, and so they are. But we never promised to take away your nightmares. No man, no god, could ever forget the terrible deeds you have done.
You can't! Athena, I've done everything you asked! You can't!
Farewell, Kratos. Your service to the gods is at an end. Go forth into your new life, and know that you have earned the gratitude of Olympus. The shimmer of the goddess faded. Kratos stood alone in the ruined temple above the shattered remnant of the city. He stood there for a long, long time. Then he started walking. Epilogue. At the brink of nameless cliffs he stands, a statue in travertine, pale as the clouds above. He can see no colors of life, not the scarlet slashes of his own tattoos, not the putrefying tatters of his wrists where chains were ripped from his flesh. His eyes are as black as the storm-churned Aegean below, set in a face white as the foam that boils among the jagged rocks. Ashes, only ashes, despair, and the lash of winter rain. These are his wages for 10 years' service to the gods. Ashes, and rot, and decay. A cold and lonely death. His only dream now is of oblivion. He has been called the Ghost of Sparta. He has been called the Fist of Ares and the Champion of Athena. He has been called a warrior, a murderer, a monster. He is all of these things, and none of them. His name is Kratos, and he knows who the real monsters are. His arms hang, their vast cords of knotted muscle limp and useless now. His hands bear the hardened callus not only of sword and Spartan javelin, but of the blades of Chaos, the trident of Poseidon, and even the legendary thunderbolt of Zeus. These hands have taken more lives than Kratos has taken breaths, but they have no weapon now to hold. These hands will not even flex and curl into fists. All they can feel is the slow trickle of blood and pus that drips from his torn wrists. His wrists and forearms are the true symbol of his service to the gods. The ragged strips of flesh flutter in the cruel wind, blackening with rot. Even the bone itself bears the scars of the chains that once were fused there, the chains of the Blades of Chaos. Those chains are gone now, ripped from him by the very god who inflicted them upon him. Those chains not only joined him to the blades and the blades to him, those chains were the bonds shackling him to the service of the gods. But that service is done. The chains are gone, and the blades with them. Now he has nothing, is nothing. Whatever has not abandoned him, he has thrown away. No friends, he is feared and hated throughout the known world, and no living creature looks upon him with love or even affection. No enemies, he has none left to kill. No family. And that, even now, is a place in his heart where he dare not look. And finally, the last refuge of the lost and alone, the gods. The gods have made a mockery of his life. They took him, molded him, transformed him into a man he can no longer bear to be. Now, at the end, he can no longer even rage. The gods of Olympus have abandoned me. He steps to the final inches of the cliff, his sandals scraping gravel over the crumbling brink. 1,000 feet below, dirty rags of cloud twist and braid a net of mist between him and the jagged rocks where the Aegean crashes upon them. A net. He shakes his head. A net. Rather a shroud. He has done more than any mortal could. He has accomplished feats the gods themselves could not match. But nothing has erased his pain. The past he cannot flee brings him the agony and madness that are his only companions. Now there is no hope. No hope in this world, but in the next, within the bounds of the mighty Styx that marks the borders of Hades, runs the river Lethe. A draught of that dark water, it is said, erases the memory of the existence a shade has left behind, leaving the spirit to wander forever, without name, without home, without past. This dream drives him forward in one final fatal step, which topples him into clouds that shred around him as he falls. The sea-chewed rocks below materialize, gaining solidity along with size, racing upward to crush his life. The impact swallows all he is, all he was, all he has done, and all that's been done to him in one shattering burst of night. But even in this, he is doomed to disappointment. He does not see the figure at his side in the Aegean's dark waves. He does not feel the hands that lift him from the sea. He does not know that he is being carried far beyond anywhere mortals can ever go. When next his eyes open, he stands before a mighty gate of gold and pearl, set in a rampart built of cloud. And with him stands a woman of supernal loveliness, clad in glittering armor and bearing a shield on which is set the head of Medusa. He has never seen her before, but he has known her for years, and she cannot be mistaken for any other. Athena. Her flawless face turns toward him, and the serene majesty of her gaze takes his breath away. You will not die this day, my Spartan, she says, and her voice is martial music of pipe and drums. The gods cannot, I cannot, allow one who has performed such service to perish by his own hand. He can only stare, struck dumb, both by bitter injustice and incomprehensible grace. There is more work at hand here than you may ever know. She lifts a hand, and the immense gate swings open before him, revealing stairs ascending into cloud. But you have saved more than your own life today, and worked a greater deed than taking your own revenge. Zeus has declared you worthy, and you will not deny him. There is now an empty throne in Olympus, my Kratos, and I have one last service to require of you. Take these stairs. They lead to that empty throne. To your throne. I don't understand. Words fall thickly from his numb lips. It's possible you never will. I will tell you only this. You should not die by your own hand and stain Olympus with your blood. And so you are here. With us. Forever. It is Zeus's wish. Kratos mounts the long, long stair. Now he can see at the top a throne of glistening jet, deadly gleaming black, befitting the god he is to become. With each step, the sights and sounds of battle rush in upon him from all across the world and throughout all eternity, for time and place are different for the gods. He fears for an instant, or for a millennium, that his nightmares return to rape his mind. But he does not recognize the soldiers he sees. They wear metal armor and march in phalanx. Cavalry and chariots support their swordsmen, pikemen and archers. Cross the Rubicon, a general bellows, in a strange and foreign tongue. But Kratos understands. At the next step, again he gasps. Curious armor here replaces the more familiar design. Rushing past him are men with Asiatic eyes, shouting in a language he does not recognize, though again he understands. Sekigahara, for the Shogun! The names spring up unbidden and mean nothing to him, But as foreign as their aspects and armor are, the carnage they wreak is all too familiar. Thousands lie dead on all sides, although he is still on the stairs to his throne. At the next step he finds himself almost flinching, as a huge bird with stiff metal wings and a spinning wheel in front dives down on him. Sudetenland. Huge explosions rock him as the machine, not a bird, but a flying machine, a Stuka, another unfamiliar word that he somehow understands, pulls out of a dive and roars away into the dirty gray sky. And just above, a brilliant glare has him squinting and shading his eyes. But he knows somehow that this light cannot harm him. Nothing can harm him. The light comes from a vast cloud curling upward from a burning city, burgeoning as it lifts into an astonishing shape, like a blazing white mushroom larger than Athens itself. He looks in another direction, and there before him unfold wooded hills where the rivers run red with blood. Antietam? What language might this be? These people, these places, come to him with every step. Waterloo, Agincourt, Khyber Pass, Gallipoli, Zalangfu, Roncesvalles, Stalingrad, and the Bulge, and Normandy. The chaos of war rages around him, an endless looping chain of stunning victories and horrific defeats. When he reaches the throne, he pauses for a moment and looks back down from whence he came. Spread before him is all of Greece, all the Mediterranean, Africa, Europe, Asia, and the strange lands on the far side of the world. Anywhere that battles rage, anywhere war will ever be fought, this is his kingdom. But among it all, his kingdom, the quarter that means most to him, will be the scene of battles that will tear the world asunder. For Olympus, too, is of his kingdom, whenever he might choose to make it so. Kratos, once of Sparta, lowers himself upon his throne, and dark designs unfurl behind his brows. They want a god of war? He will show them war, the likes of which they never conjured in their worst nightmares. Kratos of Olympus, god of war, gazes down upon his realm, and his fury burns. This concludes God of War.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.